court is ready to hear argument in 041023 in re Allied Chemical Corporation et al.
May it please the court, Mr. Bob Newman offers an argument for the relator. Relator has reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, we're here today challenging two rulings of the trial court as being an abuse of discretion. The first ruling that we challenge is that the defendants in this case were lumped together without any showing of a connection between their injury and a defendant's product as diagnosed or recognized by a doctor or a healthcare practitioner and set for trial. The second ruling of the court was or is the fact that in a case with hundreds, in this case thousands of plaintiffs, five of the most attractive plaintiffs were set jointly for trial in this matter, regardless of their appropriateness under the standards set forth by this court in the Van Waters and Rogers opinion issued in late 2004.
In terms of how those two issues interconnect, on page 30 of your brief, you say that the issue in this mandamus proceeding is not the plaintiff's failure to answer the able supply interrogatory, but rather the effect of that failure on consolidation.
Yes, ma'am. The issue is that when plaintiffs are set for, when defendants are set for trial against plaintiffs without the basic information which this court established needed to be provided in the able supply opinion, the defendants only have two options. They can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in defense costs going through the expert process, going up to the...
No, I understand all that, but my understanding, I don't understand why this isn't moot now that the cases have been deconsolidated, particularly in light of your representation in your briefing that that's the only relevance of the able supply interrogatory to the mandamus.
The able supply interrogatory and the lack of an answer to the able supply interrogatory is as relevant to a single plaintiff set for trial as to multiple plaintiffs set for trial in a mass toxic tort context.
So this statement was just incorrect.
The statement was not as concise as I wish it had been, Your Honor, and was corrected and clarified in our supplemental mandamus petition, or our brief on the merits, which we filed. Judge, the defendants are only left with two choices in this sort of a situation. They can fight the case over and over again at the expense of hundreds of thousands of dollars, or alternatively, they are forced into a situation where they have no option but to pay settlements in cases where there is no connection recognized by any physician, by any medical health care provider between their product and the alleged injuries. And this court issued its opinion in Able Supply in 1995. It is hard to believe that this court envisioned, or any court envisioned, or any legal practitioner envisioned, that a plaintiff would be able to say, no doctor recognizes that I have an injury caused by a product made by a defendant, and still get to trial, and still have defendants required to designate experts, still have defendants required to participate in the discovery process and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. That information is set out in the Able Supply opinion as being information that is needed by the defendants to prepare their basic fundamental defense to a case. It's the basic information that forms the heart of the case. The Able Supply opinion says that that is information which allows the trial court to set a trial plan.
But doesn't Able Supply also at least suggest that there may be, the answer to that sort of interrogatory may be that no doctor has made that determination?
Mr. Chief Justice, I think it actually expressly says that. It expressly says that if no doctor has made that diagnosis, defendants are entitled to know that. The problem is, what happens next? The Able Supply opinion does not talk about what happens next. What if the plaintiff says no doctor has made such a diagnosis? No healthcare provider has diagnosed an injury caused by your product.
Seems like you wouldn't have met an element of damages. There'd be no causation. So how can you go forward? Is that the argument?
That is our argument. And our argument is that mass toxic tort cases, as has been recognized by this court on numerous occasions, are a special animal. They bring a special pressure on the defendants to settle. The first opinion that I've been able to find was an opinion by Justice Specter, the CSR Limited case, where she specifically says mass tort litigation such as this places significant strain on a defendant's resources and creates considerable pressure to settle the case regardless of the underlying merits. It is my belief that Justice Specter's view of that was formed while she sat on the trial court on a case that I was involved in San Antonio that Justice Green heard on appeal 10 years later. Millions and millions of dollars in settlements and defense costs later. The case finally worked its way through the system.
But let's talk about the one case going to trial. You've got one plaintiff going to trial now. And if there's no evidence of causation, why can't you file a no-evidence motion for summary judgment?
There's multiple problems with that, Charlie. The first is that a no-evidence motion for summary judgment comes late in the game. It comes after tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars of defense costs are expended in discovery. Secondly, it does not alleviate the pressure to settle because
How is that? I mean, your first point, that's no different than mandamus. I mean, mandamusing right before trial is going to be after discovery as well.
We did not take this mandamus right before trial, Your Honor. We started this mandamus immediately following the trial court's ruling setting consolidating the five plaintiffs and overruling our objection to a trial setting because of the failure to show or failure to provide an answer to the able supply interrogatory.
In effect, you're saying defendants in mass tort cases ought to be like doctors in medical malpractice. The plaintiffs ought to have to file an expert report in the first 90 days.
Not exactly.
In other words, the doctors made all the arguments you're making. This runs up our insurance rates because we go to trial, these frivolous cases, they've got no expert that's going to say anything. We win automatically if they have no expert. Why should we have to do 5 years of litigation? But they had to go across the street and get a bill passed in law that says, okay, we agree with all that. Therefore, plaintiffs, if you're suing a doctor, you've got to have an expert report in the first 90 days. Why can't your clients do that?
Well, I don't know why my clients cannot do that, Your Honor. I suspect that they can, but that is not what we're here for.
I took the interrogatory question to be a little different in that you're just asking for what doctor, if any, has associated an alleged disease with this exposure, not requiring an affidavit, not requiring an expert, but requiring information so that you can properly depose that individual before trial.
And that is the difference. This is not a requirement of a. This is not a request for a lone pine order. This is not a request for a medical affidavit, as the legislature requires in medical malpractice. This is simply a request for an acknowledgement that a trial setting in mass toxic tort cases is what drives settlement, regardless of the merits. And hence, if there are no merits, if the plaintiffs are not able to provide the basic information that this court has held is basic to the defendants to be able to prepare their defense, basic to the court to be able to set up a trial plan, the plaintiff should not be allowed to have a jury trial set. They should sit on the docket, not unlike the inactive docket that has now been created by the legislature in the asbestos arena, but they should sit on the docket until that information is available.
So you're asking us to, in effect, create an inactive docket.
In effect, that would be correct. That would be the practical effect of it. But what I'm asking the court to acknowledge and to recognize is that the settlement pressures in a case without an answer to the able supply interrogatory in the mass toxic tort contest, it is an abuse of discretion for a judge to set such a case for trial. That is what we are asking the court to recognize. It is, and this court has recognized those settlement pressures in other cases. The Ethel case decided by this court.
But I guess the problem I'm having is, what about just a regular run-of-the-mill case? And someone says they can't prove X. So mandamus, the court can't set for trial until they prove X. That changes our whole procedural construct. It should be no evidence motion for summary judgment. That's what we do. But you want us to carve out a rule for toxic tort cases.
Yes, ma'am. That is what I am asking the court to do, to recognize.
That would apply to just toxic suitcases. That would apply to breast implants and Vioxx and everything.
I believe it would. I believe that the reasoning behind the abuse of discretion, the reason this is an abuse of discretion, would make it apply to all toxic tort cases. Toxic tort cases being cases where a plaintiff is contending that he suffers for an injury or a condition as a result of an exposure to a substance, and mass toxic tort cases, as recognized by Justice Spector, as recognized, I believe, by you, Justice Heck, in the Ethel opinion, where you discussed the settlement pressures brought by improper consolidations in a mass toxic tort context.
But we don't have consolidation here. And so you would have to just take judicial notice of settlement pressures in these type of cases. And that's why we carve out this particular procedural avenue for these types of cases.
We do have consolidation in this case, Your Honor. We have five plaintiffs that were originally consolidated. They have been deconsolidated, but there has not been any recognition by the trial court or acknowledgement by the plaintiffs in this matter that the original consolidation error, the original consolidation order, was an error. And hence, it is very capable of repetition. We have reasonable grounds to believe it would be repeated, and it meets this court's test to bypass the doctrine of
mootness. So the reasoning would be there was a consolidation in cases that are consolidated and then deconsolidated because they might be consolidated again in a massive toxic tort case because of settlement pressures, we're going to allow this avenue for relief.
I'm afraid I'm not. I don't understand.
Well,
you.
If we create this avenue, this procedural avenue, to come up here because there's a piece of evidence that people are fighting over the relevance of it, and if they don't have this piece of evidence, then you can't set the case for trial.
But you're talking about no evidence, not evidence.
We're not talking about the relevance of a piece of evidence. We are talking about an interim.
I understand. You're talking about no evidence. You're saying there's a causation piece that's missing here.
We are talking about the plaintiffs acknowledging that no doctor has made a diagnosis and tied it to a specific defendant's product. If the plaintiffs acknowledge that fact, or they do not provide an answer, a substantive answer to that interrogatory, they should not be allowed to use the legal system to coerce defendants into settling.
I understand that, but that I don't see why that argument couldn't be made in every case.
The distinction is because of the mass toxic tort docket and the settlement pressures and the issues that arise in a mass toxic tort situation, consolidated or not consolidated. The issues would be the same in the asbestos cases, in benzene cases, in Vioxx.
In car wreck cases.
No, I do not believe that would be correct because those are not mass toxic tort cases. There a defendant is not forced to rely to risk his entire company on the outcome of a trial. You additionally don't have an interrogatory that has been, in essence, sanctioned by this court and held to be the most fundamental evidence that a defendant is entitled to prior to, you know, beginning the preparation of his defense.
I appreciate that argument, but if the order is withdrawn and you as a defendant only have to go one plaintiff at a time, I mean, the risk is borne by the plaintiff as well as you in that they're going to have to expend money and possibly get thrown out of court. And the order has been withdrawn, so I'm starting to not understand your argument a little bit because now it seems to be more moot than ever if the order is withdrawn.
At one plaintiff at a time, the problem still remains. I can, in the recent media over the first trial of the Vioxx.
Could you please conclude?
The recent media over the first trial of the Vioxx case is the perfect example there. What we heard after the conclusion of the first Vioxx trial was not about whether or not the Vioxx litigation would continue because of the merits of the Vioxx litigation. We heard about whether or not the manufacturer would be forced to settle those cases because of the tens of thousands of pending cases to come.
I understand that, but in that case they had an expert, although from what I read in the paper, the expert's report was both sides had a different opinion on the expert. And here you have no expert. So that seems a little different.
It is different. but the settlement pressures are the same whether there is an expert or not. If a case is going to go to trial where the plaintiff cannot provide me the basic information to defend myself, the settlement pressures, the pressure to settle the case, regardless of the merits of the underlying litigation, are the same because of the numbers coming behind.
Having participated in litigation in Madison County, Illinois, I understand your concerns.
What order are we acting on? Are you asking us to act on
the order setting the original five plaintiffs for trial and the subsequent order setting one plaintiff for trial? Both orders entered over my objection, the defendant's objection, to a trial setting in the absence of an answer, in the admitted absence of an answer to the able supply.
But there's been no denied motion to compel. Is that correct? There's no order denying a motion to compel this information.
I think there have been orders, but that is not what is before the court. We are not seeking to mandamus an answer to the able supply interrogatory. We are objecting to a trial setting in the absence of an answer, and in the plaintiff's admitted absence of an answer to the able supply interrogatory.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Alan York will present argument for the real party in interest.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices,
Mr. York, is this issue moot?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Why would it be?
Your Honor, it's moot for several reasons. First of all, it's moot because the only order from which this mandamus action arose has been set aside by the trial court. That was an order that was entered in August of 2004 that consolidated five plaintiffs' claims for trial. Now, Justice O'Neill, as you pointed out earlier, the question here is a significant one in that we don't have an order anymore that would allow this court to enter the mandamus relief that has been requested. That consolidation order has been fully and finally set aside.
What order could you get that would prevent a judge taking 1,000 cases to trial one by one when everybody knows there's no expert that's going to provide causation? What kind of order could they get?
Well, Your Honor, I think Justice O'Neill pointed it out. I think that this is really a question of whether there are already procedural mechanisms available to the defendant, such as no evidence motion for summary judgment.
So what do you think will happen when the defendants file no evidence summary judgment motions in this case?
I think
there's at least a chance that the trial judge might deny them, right?
Well, I think that the same thing might happen that has happened with almost 600 cases already where no evidence motions for summary judgment have been filed and granted by the trial court.
Let's assume a handful of them are denied. Then what do they do? It's going to trial. What possible motion could they get other than what they're asking, which is just a rule that you can't start the trial with no evidence of causation?
Well, I think, Your Honor, first of all, they need to go to the trial court, and determine whether there has been an adequate response to the discovery. And that's a missing link in this case. There is nothing in this mandamus record that shows that there is an order from the trial court, that the trial court has reviewed the discovery responses and has deemed them to be inadequate. The premise of the entire argument presented by the defendants before this court is that there's an inadequate response to the able supply.
I understand that you're here not on a summary judgment record, but on a ruling about consolidation. But on the current state of the record, you agree, don't you, that there is no evidence linking exposure to the plaintiff's medical condition?
No, Your Honor, we do not agree.
Where is that evidence?
Actually, Your Honor,
you answer that there's no. You've gotten no doctor to say that there is a causative link between the exposure and their injury. So where is that?
Your Honor, we're really dealing with three interrogatories here. The first one asks for, or the first two ask for the chemicals that the defendant supposedly have provided that have caused injury. The second, I believe, asks for what the chemicals the plaintiffs have been exposed to. And the third asks for the identity of any treating physician who has made a link between those. The responses to those interrogatories are instructive, and the procedure that was gone through with regard to the discovery is instructive as well. There was an original motion to compel that was filed, and in response to that, the plaintiffs provided additional information, and there was about a 2-year gap where nothing was heard. After the the motion to consolidate was filed, a second motion to compel was filed by the defendants, and in response to that motion to compel, significant additional information was provided. And I filed with the court this morning, and I believe the clerk may have passed out to you, a couple of handouts that were specifically included with the supplemental responses to that discovery. Now, these handouts indicate two different things, the answers to two of the different interrogatories. The first, which is the chart with the defendants, lists each defendant by name, and more importantly, specifically lists the products that those defendants were alleged to have provided that were causative of the injuries.
And the second is a list of supportive literature. But the third, where is the expert?
Well, Your Honor, that's...
Who's going to be the witness that says this chemical caused this injury?
We have a couple of different witnesses that have been provided through expert testimony, Your Honor. One is Mr. Wolfson, and his affidavit was attached also in supplement to the interrogatories. And in fact,
what did it say?
This is the second list I'm talking about, the Wolfson affidavit.
He's going to say there is some literature out there which says, ties this chemical to that disease.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. But in addition to that, we also have the expert testimony, and I'm reluctant here a little bit to get too far into this because I will concede to the court that some of this is not in the mandamus record because this is not brought up as a discovery.
Yes, but the general question is, assuming that there is a complete and total absence of evidence of any linkage between the exposure and the disease, why should the trial go forward? I mean, that's kind of the issue. You don't have to get into the substance. We understand it's not a summary judgment record here, but the question is, why shouldn't we require at a minimum that there be some evidence of causation before all of this money and time is expended? And if there's a record that shows that there's no way you can prevail, maybe it's better for you for the courts to decide this as a matter of law early rather than later.
And Justice Jefferson, I don't disagree with that, but I think that the procedural mechanism to do that, as Justice O'Neill pointed out, is a no-evidence motion for summary judgment. But in addition, I would point out that when we return to the Able Supply case, what this court said in Able Supply was that a defendant has a right to know which products it is allegedly produced that have caused harm to the plaintiff. And I want to return briefly to some of the evidence that is in this mandamus record. In response to the third interrogatory regarding who has made the causative link, it is true that the plaintiff said no treating physician has made that causative link. But they also provided the affidavit of Dr. Sandra Moore, who explained that in a toxic tort case such as this, it is not unusual at all for a treating physician to treat the symptomology without going behind that symptomology to try to determine what actually caused it. That's why, in addition to
that... Right, but that's not going to... But the opinion that treating doctors don't normally do this is not going to allow us to dispense with causation at trial.
Absolutely.
You're going to have an expert, a live doctor on the stand, or epidemiologist, who says this exposure to caused this harm to this client. And we don't have that here. No suggestion that you have that or are ever going to have that here.
And Justice Brister, I'm put sort of on the point of a quandary. I would tell you I'm representing the court.
You do have
that here.
If you are representing to us for these 1,000 plaintiffs, we have an expert in each case who's going to say these chemicals caused each of these plaintiffs various injuries.
I will tell you that specifically for the five trial plaintiffs that were originally set for consolidation, I have expert reports from epidemiologists and physicians who go through and show specific dosage exposure and specific linkages between that exposure and the illnesses that are being experienced by the plaintiffs. The problem here is that this case was not brought up as a discovery mandamus, and so this court does not have before it the record necessary to make that determination. And that's exactly...
So you agree then with the issue that the Chief Justice raised, that a plaintiff should not be able to go to trial without this evidence. You just say you got it.
Well, let me take a step back for just a sec. I believe that in the absence of any challenge from the defendants, the plaintiff is going to get set for trial and is going to go to trial.
But if you have a mass tort case like this one, and you have scores, hundreds of plaintiffs, and you have scores of defendants, you think that it is unreasonable to put even one case to trial without evidence of causation, or not. I'm not sure.
I believe that if the trial court has examined the interrogatories under a proper motion to compel, has determined that the responses to those interrogatories are inadequate, that there is no information showing any causative link, that I don't know of anything in Texas law that would allow a sua sponte at summary judgment on the basis of no evidence, but I would certainly say that the trial court would have within its discretion the power to not set that case
to trial. Well, of course, the trial court always has that power. But what I'm asking is, if the trial court set the case for trial nonetheless, would that be an abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it would be, because the state of Texas has always recognized that while there is certainly going to be mandamus review in certain situations, the trial court has a great deal of latitude in controlling its own docket. And that really is what this case goes to. This is a case in which the trial court set originally five cases and then, after deconsolidation, one case to trial. No action by the defendants has ever asked the trial court to look at the discovery to determine whether the discovery is responses are inadequate or inadequate so that that could be taken up by mandamus.
If we were to issue the writ here, it wouldn't really impact your case then. If you've got the evidence of that linkage, and we said that this case can't go forward without providing that to the defendant, then you're going to have that when it goes back down to the trial court, right? Practically speaking, in your case.
Well, let me split it up into two things. Number one, I think it impacts all cases because I think that there's an inadequate record to provide this court any basis for granting mandamus relief, and I'm afraid that doing so in this case would be the equivalent of saying to a trial court, it is an abuse of discretion for you to set the claim of a single plaintiff for trial even when there has been no proper challenge in your court to determine whether discovery responses are adequate or inadequate. So in that procedural context, I think there is harm in this court granting a petition for mandamus on a global scale. But on a smaller scale, I would tend to agree with you to a certain degree. However, I still think that it would have a chilling effect to a certain degree in that it would be this court telling the trial court, now, you make sure and look at all these things really carefully before you decide whether you're going to set a case for trial. This trial court has already demonstrated its ability to deal with these issues. This trial court has not been shown to abuse its discretion in any manner, and I think it would be inappropriate for this court to issue even a conditional writ of mandamus to try to instruct the trial court to do something different when it hasn't done anything wrong in the first place.
One could argue, of course, in medical malpractice cases now, unlike all other cases, you have to have an expert report almost as soon as the case is filed, right?
That's
and everyone. We could do that. The legislature could do that for every personal injury case in Texas. No question about it. Wouldn't be anything unconstitutional about it at all. Say if you want to come in court, you've got to have something to back it up. Indeed, reasonable investigation, you ought to have that on every case you file, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So rather than having that in all million cases filed in Texas, what would be wrong with a rule that applied it just in a few where it seems to be abused most, like, according to the legislature, medical malpractice, and like toxic soup cases where people say just something in there, somebody did something to me?
Well, Justice Brewster, I'm reluctant to go back to my law school moot court days, but I really do believe that we opened up the door to the slippery slope problem at that point. And Justice O'Neill, you pointed this out already. Well, then it would be applicable in a car wreck case as well. And the response of the defendants was, well, no, because that's not a case where a company is risking its actual existence on the outcome of the trial.
It could be.
And
exactly.
Car wreck case, you know who did it because their car is right there plowed into yours. When you're suing how many defendants?
Approximately 30 defendants.
30 defendants, and you're saying something in the air, it's real hard to tell whose air blew over to your house.
Well,
and we know that's going to be harder than a car wreck case.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And we know there's a lot of difficulties in tying that up. Why shouldn't we say, in a case like that where we know this is going to be, recognize it, not say anything about the merits, but it's going to be hard to say whose air blew into your house. What's wrong with saying in those cases we're going to require something a little extra before we have this room for lawyers to do all these depositions and trials and stuff?
Well, Your Honor, again, I would split it into two responses. The first you pointed out already in your questioning to the relators in this case, which is that's something that the medical profession went to the legislature and was able to accomplish. If that's what they want to accomplish, they certainly have the means to do so. But the second response is that, again, I return to the idea that these procedural mechanisms already exist in Texas law. There is nothing that says that these defendants can't go forward with the information that they have in these two documents alone and either file a no evidence motion for summary judgment saying that the plaintiffs have no evidence.
So they file a no evidence motion for summary judgment, the trial judge denies it, then you would agree we could do something then?
I believe, Your Honor, if a challenge on something that is the subject, for example, of a petition for writ of mandamus, appropriate.
No, then you're telling us they need to jump through an extra hoop. And I'm just wanting to tie you down to make sure. If they jump through that hoop and the trial judge does no more than he's done here, denies it all, you agree we can do something then?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
And the well, then don't. Well, then what's the point of saying, well, they need to jump through a hoop which will make no difference?
Well, I don't think it is a hoop that doesn't make any difference. I think there's a hoop that's recognized by Texas law. And I think that in a situation such as this, this court has outlined specific areas in which mandamus relief is available. And this simply is not one of those areas. What I would say is that, again, to arguing to the idea that if what the defendants are really seeking in this case is if we file a no evidence motion for summary judgment and it is denied, then we want a right to have an interlocutory appeal from that. We also have an interlocutory appeal statute that they can seek to have the legislature expand the breadth of that. But as it exists today, this court's mandamus powers have been limited, and for good reason. And the reason for that is because we recognize and we respect the ability of trial courts to run their own dockets. And in this case, that is exactly what has happened. This trial court has run its own docket when originally, and as set out in our original response to the petition for writ of mandamus, we do believe that the original consolidation was appropriate, and we went through the Maryland factors test to establish the basis that we believe that there was significant enough commonality to support consolidation. However, ultimately, in order to, quite honestly, try to get the case of one of the plaintiffs who was most in need of having a trial to trial, the plaintiffs sought leave of this court to lift the stay order and get a deconsolidation order. Once we did that, the trial court deconsolidated and set a single case for trial. What we return to here is a challenge to an order that does nothing more than set the claim of a single plaintiff for trial. And the defendants and the relators in this case have tried to reach out beyond that order and say, well, but it's in the absence of an adequate response to able supply interrogatories, without ever having given the trial court the opportunity to address the adequacy or inadequacy of those discoveries.
But just to be clear, even if the trial judge had had that opportunity, they still could not get relief here. That's your position.
No, Your Honor. No, not at all.
I'm confused.
I apologize. If they had gone to the trial court and had sought, filed a motion to compel and sought additional responses to the able supply interrogatory, the able supply case itself would support the idea that they would have the right to seek mandamus relief for and say that allegedly these responses were inadequate and the trial court abused its discretion in holding otherwise. But that step has been completely skipped here. And it's important to note that as much as the relators have relied upon the able supply case, they have wholly failed to follow the procedures that were set out in the able supply case.
I thought your position was that you had fully answered it, that there will be no other answer except that there will be no treating physician experts.
We believe that we have fully answered it, Justice O'Neill.
So there's nothing to compel. There's nothing to go back and ask the trial court to compel.
That's correct, Your Honor. But what I'm saying is, I think Justice Heck was asking, they would have, if they filed the motion to compel, would they have? They would have no chance to seek review of that ruling. And I'm saying no. Procedurally, this court has recognized that that is an area in which mandamus relief may be available, and they could then properly seek to have a reviewing court determine whether the responses were adequate or inadequate. The
problem, your response was no medical professional has made this link, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So clearly, since you say now that you have that information, that response is not adequate.
I'm sorry, I missed it.
You said, I thought you said a little while ago that you have that information now. It's just not been requested, but that answer then is not adequate.
Well, no, I think that same, it still goes true. I believe that there was no, we have said that there's no treating physician.
It says no medical professional has made this link.
Okay. Then I believe, I don't want to try to read into it, but I know that the intent behind that was that it was no treating physician. And the reason that I know that is not just supposition, it's actually contained in the record. And that is when you read that in conjunction with Dr. Moore's affidavit, It explains that what the plaintiffs were saying was there hasn't been a treating physician that has made this causative link, but that's not unusual in a case such as this where the treating physician is going to treat the symptomology but not go behind that to try to find out the causative agents. And so in addition to that, and I'm not saying that we haven't filed these things, I'm saying we have filed our expert reports with regard to these plaintiffs that provide the causative link, that provide the information that is required to link up their exposure to their illnesses. It's just that those things are not currently a part of this court's record because of the way in which this mandamus was brought.
But if you do have that information, then you have a duty to supplement your responses so that this answer is no longer your answer.
If there is a confusion regarding those that wording, yes, Your Honor, we certainly would. But again, I think read in conjunction with Dr. Moore's affidavit, it would be clear what the intent of those words were. But I don't want to parse words with you. If that is unclear, certainly we would have a duty to supplement that in conjunction with all the expert reports that we have already filed and provided to the defendants that do establish the causative link between the exposure to their products and the illnesses that have been suffered by
those plaintiffs. Let me make sure I understand. In order for us to grant mandamus in this situation, and I presume you wouldn't disagree with this, if the court were to say that under no circumstances, no matter what other proof there is, under no circumstances can any plaintiff ever recover without a treating physician connecting the dots, regardless of what's out there, it would probably behoove you to know that earlier rather than later.
That is correct, Your Honor. If this court is going to...
But you're saying we can't make that determination without knowing what else is out there.
I don't see how, Your Honor. Again,
well, in the situation, as you said, I don't think the court could either because, in my experience in these toxic tort cases, you do have treating physicians that do treat the systems. And in the case of asbestos litigation, you may have a Dr. Craighead or somebody who's equivalent to the other side come in and link up the causation.
That's correct, Justice Zia. And I want to return. I'm sorry.
Finish your.
I just want to return briefly to what was actually required by this court in Able Supply, which involved an interrogatory that asked for a treating physician. This court's position was not so specific that a treating physician name has to be supplied. What this court said was each defendant in the state of Texas has a right to know which products it has allegedly produced that have caused harm to the plaintiffs. And the evidence that is in the record of this case shows that that has been provided. But more importantly, there is no order in this case that would justify mandamus relief.
Thank you, Mr. York.
In answer to several questions that the court asked, the real party in interest. The plaintiffs, in their brief on the merits, page 14, admit that no doctor has made a specific causation, has linked a specific product with a specific plaintiff's injury. Dr. Wolfson's affidavit, which is part of the record in this mandamus, at the conclusion of his affidavit, specifically says that he is not opining on specific causation, i.e., a specific product caused a specific plaintiff's injury. If we go back to the Able Supply interrogatory, the Able Supply interrogatory requires a physician or a healthcare practitioner, an expert. It requires the identification of an expert that links the injury with a specific defendant's product. And while it is truthfully not before the court today what is in the plaintiff's expert's report, there is nothing in the plaintiff's expert's report that say Allied Chemical produced product X that caused an injury to plaintiff Y.
But
not before the court, but that representation has been made to the court, and the defendants dispute that representation, but it is not before the court.
And don't you have an adequate remedy with the trial judge to make that argument? Put aside all the costs to the parties to piecemeal this, and that probably isn't the best idea, but don't you have an adequate remedy as it exists now?
The only remedy is, Justice Medina, the only remedy short of the creation of an interlocutory appeal, the denial of the motion for summary judgment, is to go through trial, and if a verdict is rendered against you, bring that up to the courts of appeal.
Which is true in every case.
The difference is the mass toxic tort.
So you want us to create a mass toxic tort exception to our rules?
No. I don't think it is a mass toxic tort exception. I think it is a recognition that a trial setting creates special pressures in the mass toxic tort arena. and that trial courts should not set cases for trial if there is not a substantive answer to the able supply and right query. Otherwise, this court's work in the able supply case is toothless, is meaningless.
But they say they've answered it, and they're not going to produce a treating physician, and that would require us to hold, as a matter of law, without knowing what other causation evidence is out there, as a matter of law, no one can ever establish causation without a treating physician's testimony.
Your Honor, I don't agree with that because the able supply interrogatory is not limited to treating physician. It talks about every doctor, physician, or medical practitioner. It does not have to be a treating physician at all. It has to be an expert in the medical field that can diagnose an injury and the cause of that injury. It is not limited to treating physicians. The interrogatory itself does not say treating physician. It does want to know when the plaintiff has been treated or examined by the physician, but it does not limit it to that. It simply requires the basic information that the defendant needs to prepare. And for the plaintiff to be able to say none and push the defendant through discovery, push the defendant through the expert process only to subsequently find out either they don't have a product that's involved or they do, but not until late in the game, deprives them of the rights that the able supply case says they are entitled to have, the basic information to formulate their defense.
Mr. Freeman, talk about mootness. Mr. York said the only order that gave birth to this mandamus has been set aside.
That is not correct, Your Honor. There are the subsequent order setting a single plaintiff for trial at the transcript of the hearing is attached to the record in this case, was entered specifically over our objection that any plaintiff be set for trial in the absence of an able supply interrogatory. So the able supply issue as to whether or not a plaintiff in a mass tort concept, in the mass tort arena can be set for trial is not moot. That issue is alive and well in both orders. Secondly, an exception to the mootness doctrine as to the consolidation issue exists in this matter. An exception to the mootness doctrine, first recognized by the Supreme Court, and I think first recognized by this court in the General Land Office of Texas versus Oxy case, recognizes that a matter is not moot if it is capable of repetition and if the duration of the complaint of the abuse is so short that it escapes review. The consolidation order in this case, by the plaintiff's own design, is so short in duration as to attempt to escape review. What they did was they went back into the court when this court issued a stay order, went back to the trial court and asked that the order be vacated. But in the process, they have not acknowledged, even before the court today, that that order was inappropriate. So we have a reasonable expectation, as the General Land Office case requires, of a repetition. The original order was so short in duration as to escape review by caused by the plaintiff's own action. It fits precisely within the doctrine of capable of repetition, and hence the original order is not moot, the issue as relates to consolidation, and the able supply issue is not moot, be it applied to five consolidated plaintiffs or a single plaintiff.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. The cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for this morning. The marshal now adjourn the court. Thank you.
All rise.